welcome to That 80s Show. I remember so much fun back in 1981. Ain't no place I'd rather be except for 1983. Everybody felt alive back in 1985. Everything was just like heaven. It was 1987. Boombox, New Wave, Neon, Press, Clay, Dory. These are the award-winning lyrics of the new song.
No, it's not a song. Let's be clear, it is not a song. It is the biggest earworm I've ever experienced.
It fucking is, right?
I cannot get it out of my head.
Once you hear it, you go, oh, those lyrics are so stupid and dumb and shit. And then you go, I can't unhear it.
Yeah, it's just, it lives in my head now.
Men without hats. And that's the problem. You gotta wear a hat, you gotta have ear covers, or else the earworm will get in there.
Mm-hmm.
Wear those like goofy top hats.
Yep, that's where the problem started. No hats.
They drop a song, Men Without Hats. So it's not all the men without hats, it's a man without hats and other people that are now filling in for the rest of the band. Released a new song last week called I Love the 80s.
Yep.
And we've been listening to it. Those lyrics go, he named, the fun part of it is, you can hear there, he's naming every year, and you try to guess what year is he going to rhyme, and that's the rhyming. The whole time. Everything was just fine in 1989.
Yes.
what we did this safety dance on the dance floor, we safety danced on the something like that in 1984. And it is an earworm.
They even reference one of the other songs in the song.
Their only other song. I prefer Kurt Darren's love song to the 80s, if I'm honest.
I mean, you know.
So
I think it's cool, though.
It is fun. So obviously, it is the new song from Men Without Hats.
I mean, it's not like Men Without Hats have not done a novelty song in the past.
I mean, they literally did the safety dance.
You know what I mean? Like, they're sticking to what they know.
They called it a synth pop anthem. Ivan Doroshuk, the lead singer of Men Without Hats. And it sounds like Men Without Hats, a Men Without Hats cover band. Because it's the Men Without, it's the safety dance.
Dun, yeah.
Dun, 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 but done in just a different way. It makes me wonder. I wonder if he actually owns the rights to his biggest song. Because the changes to the song are so slight to not get sued. But it really makes me wonder, does he own the rights to that song? And of course, a new album's coming from Men Without Hats. Love 80s music, love 80s bands. I don't feel like I needed another Men Without Hats album.
Yeah.
He's having fun. They're having fun. We'll have fun when we're talking about the 1980s.
And he's, you know, harkening back. I can't even think of the
word. Morten harkening back.
To a time that was good. And I mean, that's what we do on the show every time.
We do. And what also a lot of people been harking back to Live Aid. It's the 40th anniversary of the concert. Was it this past weekend or this coming? Dari, I don't know where we are. We're recording the shows in a whole bunch of different formats.
But I did see something on CNN about it.
Yeah.
40 years since Live Aid.
A lot of really cool things happening about it. Of course, there's like, you know, everyone giving their thoughts on it. I saw on the BBC, you can go watch the whole original concert. There are radio stations flighting the entire 10 hours of the concert, remastered.
Wow.
I learned a fun fact about it.
Yeah?
Phil Collins. We love Phil Collins.
Yep.
I think I've heard this before, but I was reminded of it. He performed at both Live Aid. So they obviously had the Live Aid at Wembley, and then they had the Mirror concert in Philadelphia. And obviously there was a time difference that 8 o'clock in London is different to 8 o'clock in Philadelphia. Phil Collins finished his set, took a helicopter from Wembley to Heathrow, got on the Concorde, the most 80s of airplanes, flew to Philadelphia in 3 hours and performed at the Live Aid then. He basically went back in time to perform at Live Aid, Philly, before he performed at Live Aid, London. Fun fact.
He went Back to the Future.
He did. A year before Back to the Future, the same year. Anyway, that's what he was doing. And everyone's in their feels, Live Aid, so great, was the best. But some people popped up, said, didn't love it.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't love what was going on. So an author, a journalist at the time, Michael Burke, he was covering Africa, and he said, The first time I heard about Live Aid, I was filled with real anger. Okay. He said, I kind of looked at what Bob Geldof was doing and thought he had a bit of a white savior complex. Now, we've heard about this before. He said that his first reaction to Live Aid was real anger. He's a presents on BBC's 10 o'clock news, right? Okay. BBC News at 10, as it's known now. And he says he was filled with real anger. He thought it was superficial grandstanding pop singers who were riding high on the back of people who he felt very protective of.
Yeah.
There was a lot of that criticism at the time.
I think a lot of the problem was that Bob Geldof was not a particularly well-liked individual.
To this day, still divisive.
He was a bit, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But let's break this down to the, let's strip this down. People were starving in Africa. People still are. But let's go back to 1985. People really genuinely, there was a problem. These artists really genuinely gave up time, did not take money. Money did get there.
And still does.
What else matters?
Live Aid still generates, and the programs and the initiatives they set back then still run today.
Can everyone just calm down and just say, okay, cool.
So let's give Michael Burke his due. He says, I didn't watch it. And in fact, on the afternoon of Live Aid, I was in a black township just to the east of Johannesburg being tear gassed. And he said, of course, South Africa is one of the very, very few countries that didn't show it. I'd imagine they wouldn't have shown Live Aid on TV.
Yeah.
Speaking about the famine in Ethiopia, he added, I've never seen anything like this. There was a lot of drought and a lot of hunger. And he said, in South Africa in the 80s, we didn't see the famine and death at that scale. But, you know, South Africa had its own challenges. I was very concerned when I got back to Nairobi about how to tell the story because I was there and I was just not seeing it, but hearing it and smelling it. And I wondered what the reaction would be for the people who'd be sitting and watching it in the comfort of their own homes, cup of tea, glass of beer or something. And it's just on in two dimensions in the corner of the living room. But asked about how he feels about Live Aid. Now, he said, I think it was extraordinary, really. I think Geldof, the personality, the intelligence, the focus, the foul-mouthedness, just an extraordinary person. It was a moment in time, wasn't it? So, big charity got to him.
Okay.
Big Bob. So he was a cynic, didn't like it at first. Then he's like, you know what?
And then, I mean, we're going to say, well, what were you doing? What were you doing to feed these starving children in Africa?
No, nothing. Do they even know?
This Christmas.
Do they even know there's snow in Africa? So these are all the things. But it's good. You know, you got to have the color of it. Because it's, but I like this. Oh, I didn't like it. But now I like it. What's the cynic versus the skeptic? Whose mind can you change? A cynic. I think a cynic, you can't change your mind.
Yeah, yeah.
A skeptic, you can. I'm a skeptic of everything.
Okay.
Skeptic of the show. Skeptic of what's coming up. Got a great headline for the next little segment, Dory. What you talking about, Shannon?
Oh.
You know what's coming, yeah?
I do.
You know what's coming, yeah? So we go back to our good friend, Gary Coleman. Loved him from the 1980s. And of course, we know he died suddenly in 2010 from a fall. He took a fall.
I'd forgotten that, hey? I in my mind, he had died of like a heart attack or something. I'd forgotten that that's how he died.
Now, we obviously weren't doing that 80 show in 2010, or else we would have covered it then. But yes, he took a fall. And the controversy of it was, like even friends, like in this, friends of his in this article say, like, let's be honest, not be a dick. I'm paraphrasing. He didn't have that far to fall, right? So how bad a fall?
Did he not fall downstairs?
He fell downstairs. But of course, think about it. He's not huge, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's not. And
the shorter you are, the better your center of gravity,
right?
So you don't fall as often.
And as short people ourselves, we got that.
Yes.
I got a big bum as well. So it like helps me navigate it.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk about he had the fall. His wife, Shannon Price, she obviously gets taken to hospital. They call 911 and she took him off life support. He wasn't comatose. He was talking. He was responding. But she made the call to take him off life support, which she had every right to do. She was, you know, had the pull the plug permissions. And so that was it, right? So 911 call goes, there's just blood all over and I can't do anything. She had been sick, she added, and didn't want to be traumatized. She says years later, nobody else would know what to do. or what it was like in the situation until you're in that situation. A lot of people didn't think I was there for him. So I definitely have tried to fix what I had said in the call. They were, of course, married at the time. She had the authority to pull the plug. She said, the doctors advised me that he wasn't going to make it. His heart was giving out. It was going to stop regardless. It was the most difficult decision I've ever had to make in my entire career, or in my entire life. Seeing Gary in that circumstance was best for him to go and not suffer. Once the decision was made, he was gone immediately. When they took him off, his heart rate went down to 60, and then they turned the machines off. He was gone that quick. The last thing Coleman told her was, I love you and my head hurts. So she claims, of course the doctors claim. So this story still goes, people like, you know, they ask why didn't they give life, you know, saving measures. Anyway, the story goes that they were having a fight and she pushed him down the stairs, right? Let's get to the nitty gritty of it.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is what, I mean, this is what his parents have said. This is what friends have said. There's always been this little thing because she was, there was a history of her infantizing him. And being abusive towards him.
Yeah.
So he would often show up with marks, signs that he had been abused, right? And this was kind of a thing in Hollywood. And his friends knew about it. And there's always been rumors. Of which she said, it's all bullshit. I found him in the kitchen. When the police came and the ENT came, he was still in the kitchen. What I think happened was we had a kitchen stand. And I think he had hit it when he fell. She said, there's always a need to be a bad guy. And no one's ever found her guilty. Accident, he did fall and hit his head. Why is it a story, though?
Because for some reason...
there's a trash TV show on America, in America, where celebrities take lie detector tests.
For fun.
Okay. So who would have fucking heard about this show otherwise? So, yes, there is a show called Lie Detector, where a former FBI agent... hooks up people to a lie detector test and asks them about controversial stuff in their past. And now we all know that lie detector tests can be hacked. They're not accurate. They're not admissible in court.
No.
I love it when I see somebody say, I don't care what they say. I'll take a lie detector test. Mm. Yeah, well, fucking do it. Doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
Okay, they can be hacked. But this TV show does not care, nor do we, because we need content. Mm. And when she was asked... did you have any parts to... So the question was, did she physically cause Coleman's fall? She said no, but the test said deception
liar.
Indicated.
Liar.
Oh, she's mm-hmm. in faith. She says, I know where I'm at. I'm at peace. There's a reason I'm not in prison. There's a legit reason for that. It's because they did a thorough investigation.
Yeah, it is weird, though. Like, let's assume that she... did do something dodge. Why would she agree to go on the show? And even if she didn't do something dodge, like, why risk it?
Yeah. Or you don't know how people work. You don't know how people work.
So weird.
You know, he's got demons. It's 15 years after the fact she's carried these accusations. She carried the
anyway,
accusations
still
before.
Nothing's going to happen to her. So no. It doesn't really make a difference. It's just, like you say, it's created a weird story.
You know, there were two things that I think fucking we were petrified of in the 80s as kids.
Mm-hmm.
Quicksand?
Yep.
But have you as an adult ever seen quicksand? I've seen sand that sinks. I've seen stuff getting stuck in mud. No quicksand.
Right.
Never. And lie detector tests.
Yeah.
Somebody had to say to you, oh, I'm going to give you a lie detector. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Like, they're going to know what I'm doing. And then as you go through the years, you go, what a lot of shit. Like, your heart rate. Of course your heart rate's going to go up when you're nervous.
Yeah.
Of course you're going to have breathing and, you know. You know that thing of like where people say, if you can't make eye contact when you're telling a lie, you're telling a lie. Or they know when you're not making eye contact, you know that whole eye contact thing about lying.
Yeah.
I'm so conscious of it that sometimes I'll be dead telling the truth, but it's a weird story and I break eye contact. I'm like, fuck.
Yeah.
Now I look like I lied. But it's just, I'm so conscious of it, lying, not lying. You know?
It's easier just not to lie at all.
Nah, fuck.
That is the easier thing. But fuck, tell that to Shannon.
Why get out of bed? Why get out of bed in the morning?
Look, I think Shannon's dodgy, but it's too late. Nothing's going to happen now.
Yeah, no. That's sad. It's a sad story. It's a terribly sad story. You know, Gary Coleman's entire career, life was a sad story.
Yeah, yeah.
I think his parents disowned him. They only came back into the picture when he was famous. Horrible stuff. So we're going to jump straight into a movie recommendation this week, Dory. I'm going to fire up the blades. Fire up the engines. Do you fire up the engines? Mm. Because here's the thing, right? Once you start watching an unknown and forgotten 80s in the sky based movie about so many of them more get recommended to you. So a few weeks ago, Clint Eastwood, Firefox.
Yes.
So cool. That is a big load of shit.
Mm-hmm.
Air Force based movie, aeronautical plane. I don't know. But if I had to say to you, Dory, of course, there was only one secret operative helicopter-based series in the 80s. What are you going to say it was?
Airwolf.
Okay, well, I'm going to say, in fact, there were two. And in fact, Airwolf ripped off their concept from my movie this week, 1983, called Blue Thunder.
All righty.
Okay.
Where are you finding them?
They find me now. Mm-hmm. They find me now. But Dory, why don't we remember this movie better, right?
Movie, not series.
Hmm.
Huh.
Right.
Right.
So we're in 1983, and just like Clint Eastwood was in his movie, was a Vietnam War vet with post-traumatic stress disorder, we meet Frank Murphy, not Alex Murphy, Robocop. Frank Murphy, played by Roy Schneider. Yes, great call. You're going to do that a lot in this movie.
Okay.
And he's also a Vietnam War vet with PTSD.
Okay.
And he's a little bit of a loose cannon, but he's a fantastic helicopter pilot. And Blue Thunder is the super sophisticated secret government weapon helicopter. Do you want to hear some of the things that it has, Dory? Some of the weapons?
The specs?
Oh. A 20-millimeter cannon. I don't know if that's good or not.
20-millimeter?
I don't know. I don't know if that's good or not. Video surveillance, microphones, thermal imaging, and whisper mode. It's basically an iPhone 10.
Right.
But anyway, this is fantastic. I mean, because helicopters make noise.
Yes.
You can't stealth a helicopter. Stealthy helicopter. Looks fantastic, this helicopter, by the way. Not Airwolf.
Yeah.
Okay, because Airwolf is based on like a real helicopter. This was a made-up helicopter. Imagine Kit as a helicopter.
Cool.
Okay? Not even. Kind of like, actually, no. Imagine the DeLorean.
Ooh.
Time machine as a helicopter.
And so did it not look like a helicopter?
It looked like a helicopter, but it was DeLorean-ishy.
Okay.
Okay? Now, I know you just put helicopter blades on a DeLorean. No. The DeLorean formed into a helicopter.
Okay.
Pictures be that 80 show SA Facebook page.
Yes.
So it's this near silent, ultra alert, the secret weapon. And he is, even though he's unreliable, but he's super like, he's a good guy. Like his morals are right. He did and saw shit in Vietnam, but he's about like making things right now. And he's the only person that they trust to fly this thing, right? So he is now flying this helicopter. He's the best pilot. It does shit that a helicopter can't do, like Airwolf, right? And he then uncovers that he's part of a secret conspiracy called Project Thor, right?
Thor, T-H-A-W?
T-H-O-R. Yeah, Thor, as in the god of thunder.
Okay.
And this Thor project is within the government, and it's run by his Vietnam rival. He had a rival in Vietnam. They were not the Viet Cong.
Of course not.
Yes, they flew in Vietnam together, rivals. Played by Malcolm McDowell.
Ooh.
You see, again, you see.
Yeah.
So now he wants to use Blue Thunder to suppress the citizens for urban unrest. Are we Donald Trumping here? You know, art is displayed in real life. Okay. So that's what they're testing this helicopter for. This thing's a death machine. And they're going to use urban unrest. You fuck around, you protest, we're using this thing against you. So he's upstanding. He's like, no, fuck this. I've got to stop this. There's a scene, Dory, while they're testing it. Now, the whole thing is they're testing it like in an urban environment, right? They're flying through Because he can't understand why the fuck are we doing this in built up areas? Why does it matter that it can go so close to the ground? Why does all these things matter? No.
Yeah.
Don't worry. Kabul. Well, I don't know. We'll do it there. They blow up a barbecue burger joint, a barbecue chicken joint. I have never in the history of cinema seen fucking barbecue chickens rain down upon the land.
Oh.
For no reason. Okay, so they shower LA with these flaming chickens. Barbecue chickens all over the place.
Okay.
Two things can happen there. You can go, fuck, it's disgusting. I can never eat chicken again. Or you go, totally feel like chicken. Like that Super Size Me movie?
Yes.
How badly did you want a McDonald's after that?
Went to go McDonald's straight off.
Straight away. I did not take the message in.
No.
No. Same thing here. So now the rest of the movie is about him uncovering the plot and no one believes him. They say, no, you're just traumatized. You're just imagining things from the Viet Cong. He's got to be the right guy. And it ensues until we end up with this big dogfight over the city of LA and buildings get blown. It's very destructive. So even Roy Schneider, who played Frank Murphy, he says, like, I hated the end of this movie because the character that I played would never allow for fucking missiles were going into office buildings, all pre 9/11. Missiles were going to office buildings, like civilians were dying in this final battle. And he goes, I hated it. My character would never do that.
Gratuitous, eh?
Just for no reason.
Mm.
Because my character was not this person. Like, why wouldn't he have taken the dogfight out into the desert? You know? I mean, so he says, just bullshit. So he actually hated it. So anyway, crazy dogfights. It ends up with the one helicopter landing on a plane, on a train, and the train blows up. Again, 80s. You know when they realize they're running out of money or they didn't shoot something? This is what I love about, like, as I uncover these 80s movies. They get to a point where they go, fuck, we shot that, but now it doesn't make sense at the end, and now we got to reshoot this. This is the point you get after the big dogfight. So that is the movie Blue Thunder. And it's as spectacular as that.
So it was never a series, just a movie.
So, fun fact, Malcolm McDowell, deathly afraid of flying. And pretty much half of him in this movie is in a helicopter. Right? And it's not like, it's like green screen. There's green screen, but there are parts where he actually had to fly. So he was just fucking petrified all the time,
but
vomiting.
But he took the role voluntarily. I mean, nobody held a gun to his head, I'm sure.
No, of course not. So another fun fact, Roy Schneider, the reason he took this movie is because he didn't want to make Jaws 3, which is also pertinent this week because it's the 50th anniversary of the first Jaws coming up, but he is like, he saw the script of Jaws 3. He's like, no, I got to sign up for something else to get out of this. So, of course, Malcolm McDowell, we know him from A Clockwork Orange and Caligula. Daniel Stern's also in this movie, he of Home Alone.
Yes.
He was like a young pilot. It was directed by John Badham, who directed not only War Games, but Short Circuit. Right. And the writer wrote Alien and Return of the Living Dead. So like, they had a really good, solid cast here.
How have I never heard of this? And like, I mean, it made very little impact, obviously.
So the reason, and this is just bad timing. This happens so much in movies. Your release is so bad. They're released in the same weekend as Return of the Jedi. So all like airtime, all the oxygen in the film watching universe gets sucked up by Return of the Jedi, right?
Yeah.
So that was one of the big reasons.
Okay.
And they had then said, okay, well, we fucked it. We've released. We know we got home video. We know we got a VHS release. So if what we didn't make in the cinema, it's a great movie. It's a great watch at home movie. Let's release it on VHS. We'll make our, we'll do it then. Someone takes a story and fucking creates Airwolf the very next year.
So now they
pop out, no one heard about it. And they go, why the fuck is this movie ripping off Airwolf?
And they
had then also trying to do shenanigans, they had heard that they're going to make this TV series called Airwolf. So they commissioned their own TV series starring Dana Carvey, of all fucking people.
Oh, jeez.
Dana Carvey's a lot of things.
Yeah.
Genius comedian of our time.
Action hero?
No.
Not so much.
Even a helicopter pilot. Like,
yeah.
I mean, you know.
Come on.
Not fucking Dana Carvey. It short-lived, didn't last. So they just shat the bed in general.
And that's crazy because, I mean, the cast is way better than Airwolf.
Hugely.
Sorry, Jan Michael.
Well, from the movie. I mean, yeah. The cast of the movie. Of course, so the director and the writer went on to do the TV series. Went on to do the TV series. Obviously, none of the cast or the actors remained. But one of the things that I was reminded, Dory, did you ever hear about the Twilight incident that changed the way that set the new standard for how you're supposed to film, especially aerial flights and helicopters in Hollywood?
This sounds familiar.
So John Landis in the 80s, massive director, Blues Brothers, Trading Places, Three Amigos, Coming to America, Beverly Hills Cop, Werewolf in London, Thriller. You know, he's like a big time director, and they were shooting a movie, the Twilight Zone movie.
Yeah.
And a whole bunch of directors got to shoot little different stories. Mm. So he was shooting one called Time Out, which involved a helicopter flying in a city. He ignored everyone's safety instructions. He wanted to shoot the helicopter scene exactly how he shot it. He flew. He didn't get permissions. He ignored the pilot. He ignored everyone on the set. And he ended up killing not only the pilot of the helicopter, the actor, and two children.
Yes, of course. I remember that story. It was yes.
Yeah. So this is what they called the Twilight incident.
Okay.
Him and Steven Spielberg, plus other four crew members, got charged with involuntary manslaughter.
Yeah.
There was a 10-month trial. They all get acquitted. Families receive settlements and whatever, but it completely changes the way they shoot movies in Hollywood. And one of the movies that had an impact on was Die Hard, because Die Hard was supposed to have this massive helicopter set piece within a city, and they're like, you can't do that. Mm. The judgment kind of got passed as they were plotting or planning or about to shoot Die Hard. So they're like, no, you got to change everything. So it was found that the children they had were hired illegally. They weren't American citizens. They were two Vietnamese kids.
I was about to say they were Vietnamese, yeah.
Yeah. So more so, this movie is a legacy and effect of so many things.
Huh.
Right? It's impacted by that.
Yeah.
Airwolf literally stole its thunder. I mean, here's just the comparison between Blue Thunder and Airwolf. Both are high-tech military helicopters. Both pilots are ex-government, but feel betrayed by the government, so now using it for their own personal missions. They're both against secret government conspiracies. So there's Thor, which is a secret project. And Airwolf, remember, there was the firm.
Yes.
That he was always against.
Oh, my goodness.
They're both Vietnam War vets, one with PTSD and one with brooding loner syndrome.
Do you think it's just because, like, it's the obvious storyline?
It is the obvious story, but it's been said,
coincidence.
Like, no, there's been people admitting, like, no, we had the idea.
Mm.
We knew this. We had seen the script. So people had seen the script of Blue Thunder.
Yeah.
And fucking just adapted. We're going to go to TV
with
this.
There's no excuse for that. Come on. Terrible.
Listen, Blue Thunder, great looking, not Airwolf. So even though if you did rip it off, I think you did it better.
Okay.
You know, in terms of, I mean, are we here?
Also, music. The music?
Listen, very synthy soundtrack.
Yeah.
They also had a great composer doing it, by the way. I never know composers, but when you see what they do. Very synthy soundtrack, not Airwolf.
Yeah.
Not the Airwolf soundtrack. So basically in the score, Blue Thunder versus Airwolf, Airwolf always wins. It's not even a fight. Not even a dog fight over a city.
Yeah.
And I guess it gives me a chance to say Jean-Michel Visson once again. 3 weeks in a row, I've said that. Another big thing happening in the 80s versus week is the new Superman movie has come out.
Yes.
I haven't seen it yet, but our good friend Celeb Savant went to go see it. And my judgment when he goes to watch a movie is if he likes it, I won't. If he hates a movie, I'll love it, right? We got completely different tastes, complete opposite tastes. He loved Superman.
Yeah, that doesn't mean you're not going to like it.
I think I'll love Superman because all the reviews, I love James Gunn, did great stuff with Guardians of the Galaxy, did great stuff with, what's it, John Cena show that's just gone over my head. He's doing a great job with it, and he's made it look more like the 1980s Supermans, the 70s and 80s Supermans. Now, of course, Christopher Reeve wasn't the only person playing Superman in the 1980s.
He wasn't?
No, Dory. There was a TV show called Superboy.
Okay.
Which is a TV show nobody ever needed.
Superboy.
It started in 1988, but it tells the story that Smallville did way better of Superman as a young boy growing up.
Ah, okay.
Okay. So we know that story. It's what happened when he was in Smallville and what was he doing. And unlike in Smallville, he doesn't get his powers. This, he's got his powers. He's Superman, but he's young. But he looks like older Superman. It's just the Superman hero was even before Lois and Clark.
Mm.
Which is great. So it's the kind of forgotten Superman in the history of the Supermans.
Who was the star?
Exactly.
Yeah.
The guy who played in season one, they completely changed season two. Didn't mention it. They didn't even do one of those. The role of Superman will now be. No. Well, I mean, they just changed it and no one was going to notice. No big stars came out of it. No, nothing. It was literally a TV show no one ever needed.
This is kind of popular. Maybe people will like this.
It was a rights thing. So yeah. The guys who did the rights for the movie, when they sold, so obviously the first three Supermans were produced by one production company. When they sold it to Canon, they sold Superman, but they didn't sell any other variation of Superman. Right. So they still kept Superboy, the whole rights thing. And they said, well, we got to make it or we're going to lose the rights. A lot of that shit happens. Ran for fucking 5 years.
Really?
Right. Kind of like would have back end into Lois and Clark then.
So was it like episodic where every episode he saved someone?
Saved someone. The stories are actually, like, fans of Superman say are really good because a lot of Superman comic book artists and writers at the time were writing for the TV series. So the storylines are actually really good and solid, even though everything, the CGI is hilarious. I mean, considering we're in 1988 and by now we had figured out a lot of shit.
Mm-hmm.
The CGI is ridiculous. You can see the stuff was done on a ridiculous low budget, a lot of turnaround time. But I was just thinking, it's like, we've got so many Supermans in the world now. Yeah. We had Supergirl. Oh, Supergirl. Give me a chance to
have
talk
a
about
moment.
Supergirl.
I have. My only memory of Superman watching the originals with Christopher Reeve as a child. I only remember that scene where he saves the kid from Niagara Falls. That's literally all I remember.
And apparently they recreate that in the new Superman movie. So they take so many little homages.
Oh, okay.
Will we see Richard Pryor in the new Superman? Do we want to? So another little fun fact about Superman. So of course we have Superman. We're going to... So the first three Supermans made by the same production company. The Superman 1 and 2 shot at the same time because of Marlon Brando's schedule. Okay? Bet you didn't know that.
Did not?
No. So they had to shoot Superman 1 and 2 at the same time.
Was this because of The Godfather?
No, it's just Marlon Brando was impossible to work with.
Well, that we know.
Yes. So they had to shoot the two. Then they had three, right? So they kind of knew what they didn't know. And then for Superman 4, they had sold the rights to Canon, my favorite fucking production, movie production house ever. And at this point, Christopher Reeve had enough. He was like, no, fuck us. This is bullshit. This thing's spiraling out of control. I love Superman. Basically, we're just fucking making a Richard Pryor movie now.
Yeah.
Like, and he was like, I want to do it. Here are some of the people that they offered the role to or they considered of replacing Superman. Now, if you think of Christopher Reeve, he's like the perfect Superman. Like, he is just Superman. Yeah. He's just perfect. And nobody else, I think everyone will always be compared to him.
Yeah.
And that's why we kind of get disappointed with Superman, because you go, the first guy you cast was perfect. But they're like, okay, if you don't want to do this movie, here are some of the people that we are going to offer this too. And at this point, Gene Hackman and Margot Kidder didn't want to be involved in it anymore because they're upset about how the director was being treated. They're just like, no, this is bullshit. We've signed on, but we're out. That's why Margot Kidder, Lois Lane, completely gets written out of Superman towards the end. But here's who they offered to play the role. Kurt Russell?
No.
You can't see him as a Superman.
No.
Jeff Bridges?
No.
Right. And we're talking like late 80s now.
I know.
John Travolta.
No.
But the most serious consideration, I shit you not, again, while we don't play 280 Truths and a Lie, they seriously consider, he had actually agreed to it, Tony Danza.
I was about to say Tony Danza. I was going to say, it's either John Stamos or Tony Danza.
Hey, yo, whoa, wait. I'm Superman.
That is hilarious. No. No.
Do you know there's like an alternate universe where Nicolas Cage wanted to play Superman? He was going to fund his own Superman movie, right, in the 90s. I don't know if you know this.
No,
right?
I don't.
He does get to play Superman in The Flash. They do like alternate timelines, and Nicolas Cage finally gets to show up as Superman, right?
Okay.
It was always his dream.
Yeah.
Fuck that. Alternate universe with Tony Manelli is fucking Superman.
That is ridiculous.
There's no way he's pulling it off. He's so... Brooklyn, New York. He's so New York. He can't be Superman. Are you not? The thing about Christopher Reeve, as big as he is, when he's Clark Kent, you believe he's weak.
Oh, yeah.
Tony Danza's. So if you can do a Superman, how can you do a Clark Kent?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Tony Danza's not fucking Clark Kenting. Tony Danza's fucking pure man, right? He is not. Well, maybe he is the Man of Steel.
I mean,
well, yeah. We'll leave that there. We've been very well behaved this episode. This has been That 80s Show. Airwolf ripoffs pushing beloved 80s stars down the stairs. And a great new 80s song by Men Without Hats.
Listen at your peril.
And not because it's bad, because it's going to get stuck in your head.
It'll never leave.
Ever. There's a safety dance chirp in there, but I don't really know what it is. Everything on That 80s Show essay on Facebook. Thanks for joining me, Dory.
Bye.
Bye.